This is the Jeff Merrick Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
This is indeed, and welcome back to it across the Sportsnet Radio Network, simulcast on Sportsnet 360. Coming up top of the hour, we'll have a conversation with Brian Burke, executive director of the PWHL, also a former general manager. We'll talk a lot about the GM's meetings in Florida, just from a sort of how things work, how things get from one person's brain to becoming an agenda item. Berkey's been responsible for a lot of the changes in the game, and we'll go over some of those with Berkey. Also, Rick Nash will be the general manager at Team Canada at the upcoming World Hockey Championships. In the meantime, someone that I'm never jealous of because he spends so much time with one of my favorite people in all of hockey, Lou Nanny, is the one and only Michael Russo from The Athletic, who joins me now. Michael, how are you, bud?
I'm doing well. How are you, Jeff?
I am doing well. But before we get on to pressing affairs, whether it's the Minnesota Wild or issues coming out of the general manager's meeting, you know how much I love talking about Lou Nanny, and I always say he's the best president slash commissioner the NHL never had. Do you have a thought? I mean, I know you spent some time, you and Elliot. I mean, Elliot was gloating about it, getting to spend some more time and having dinner with Lou Nanny. 60 years calling the state high school championship coming to an end. His decision to do it, going back to, I want to say, like 1964, when Lou was still a player, is when he started. It's a remarkable streak. Do you have a thought on that, and just a thought on where Lou Nanny is at in his life right now?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, where he's at is he's the hardest working 82-year-old I've ever met in my life.
Yeah.
I mean, he still works full-time, still travels the globe for work. Nobody lives his life better than Lou.
Yeah.
And he's got endless energy. Like, he's 82. Like, I don't know about you, but as I've gotten older in my life, every time I get on a plane, I don't care, like, what time. Like, sometimes I'm amazed that, like, when I was a young reporter, I could just go and go and go. And now,
yeah,
it's like, if I fly anywhere, I'm just tired the rest of the day.
Yeah.
This guy flew home from the Turks the other day, landed in Miami at 3 o'clock, took a car service up to West Palm. I would have definitely texted Mike Russo and Elliot Friedman to say, hey, I'm going to cancel dinner tonight. I'm tired.
Yeah.
We show up at the bar. He had the car drop him off at the restaurant, and there he is at the bar. So, he's just amazing. And in terms of his, he's synonymous with Minnesota high school hockey and the state tournament that he has called for, as you said, 60 years.
Yeah.
In typical Lou Nanny fashion, he's driving home last year in a snowstorm one day, gets a flat tire, drove like 12 miles back on a bald tire because he wasn't about to fix it on the side of the road. coming back from the state high school tournament, he's like, you know what? This is it. I'm not doing this. Why the hell am I doing this? You know, next year's perfect. 60 years is a round number. And it worked out awesome because, you know, not especially somebody at his age, to get an entire week of everybody, you know, honoring you and giving you standing ovations. And it was really sweet. And just another reminder is that at least in my 20 years here in Minnesota, I haven't met somebody that's just as universally beloved as Lou. And, you know, it's just, he's got a weekly radio show here on Guerrero and KFAN, and people just love listening to him and talking to him. And he's the most, you know, jovial, charismatic guy, even at this age. And his stories are also, like, a lot of us, when we tell stories, Jeff, we're like broken records. You hear the same story over and over again.
Yeah.
I have had 1,000 meals with this guy, and I'm telling you, every time he tells stories, they're just different. You know, like, you never heard that one, and that one, and that one, and he just held court with Elliot and me at dinner.
I'll tell you, I can still remember my dad when I was a kid. I would have been 8 or 9 years old talking about hockey as I did on a daily basis with my father. And, you know, one of the things he would always come back to, he'd always say, Jeff, just so you know, the smartest man in hockey is not in Toronto, not in Montreal. The smartest man in hockey is in Minnesota. Lou Nanny. I've never forgot that. I can still see my dad sitting on the couch and saying that to me. The smartest man in hockey is in Minnesota. He's not in Montreal. Speaking of Minnesota, the Minnesota Wild. Can this team do it? Is there enough there? Every now and then I say yes. And then I see games like the LA game and I say no, and I cross my fingers for the upcoming game against the Blues and I say maybe, but what do you say, Mike Russo?
Yeah, I don't think so. I've long thought they're out, even when they were pulled within 2 or 3 points here recently. I mean, they just, you know, in terms of the pace that they've been on, the guys that they still have out of the lineup, it just is, is super hard. But what disappoints me about them is that what happened against LA, this is not the first time. You know, yeah, that was a game that I wouldn't equate it to exactly what I saw in Nashville a couple weeks ago when they went there and had to win that game and absolutely were atrocious and didn't show up. You know, this game was a 6-0 loss where there were some bad bounces, but they did it to themselves. And this has happened over and over again where they've just all year long against the teams that are higher than in the standings lose. They've been atrocious in their own division. And they've largely taken advantage of the lesser lights in the league. And so I don't think that they're for real. There's many reasons for it. Obviously we've talked about their lack of depth because of the cap situation. We've talked about the endless injuries that they've had this year to huge players and having to be without Jared Spurgeon basically for the entire year. And at times, Jonas Brodin for a lot of it. The responsibility that's thrown on guys like Brock Faber and things like that, but their bottom six has been terrible. They've had a lot of underachievers in the lineup, like Hartman and Johansson and Boudreau. And if Kirill Kaprizov doesn't get you 3 a night, you're usually not winning. And that's and their goaltending hasn't been outstanding. So yeah. So it's I just don't look at them as like if they were chasing like three teams maybe, but they're chasing Vegas, and Vegas is about to I think take off.
Big win last night for Vegas over the Seattle Kraken, as you well know. You mentioned Hartman there a second ago. Rewinding to that LA game, because there was a whole lot in that, Hartman with Pierre-Luc Dubois, and then it turned into Dubois going at Brock Faber, which I would imagine would have upset the Minnesota Wild bench greatly. How did you see that entire sequence playing itself out?
Yeah, I mean, well, Hartman had a lot of frustration on that shift because it was one of his first in a long time. He was benched virtually the entire second period. In fact, when I just was leaving John Hines' presser, I was about to ask that question because I'd love to know his thoughts on Hartman and maybe why he's not paying the piper today. Like, Ryan Hartman in the first period cost him the first goal, cost him the power play goal, cost him the third goal, and then didn't see the ice basically the entire second period. So I think he came out, and now he's getting talked to by one of the assistants in the meeting here. But, I think in the third period, he had won a lot of energy from basically not playing in the second, and two, he was obviously pissed off. And so, try to get into the battle with Dubois. Dubois and him got into the sword fight, the cross-check, and obviously Ryan tried to drop the gloves with him and all that stuff. I heard everything that obviously Brian Boucher said about Dubois then trying to essentially escape the ref and going at Faber and how that wasn't a great look for him. But to me, it was just something that happens in a hockey game. I think the worst look was just the way the Wild played all night.
Yeah. How do you, listen, we've been talking so much about Brock Faber since the beginning of the season and, what a tremendous start to the season he had. Listen, Connor Bedard is back and running away with this thing as far as the Calder goes. Where do you see Brock Faber in that mix? And where do you see Brock Faber right now? Like, I understand all the things you talk about, Spurgeon and Brodin and, the blue line's been decimated and a lot falls on the shoulders of a young rookie here. How do you see Brock Faber right now, Mike?
He's obviously had a great season and about to get a monster extension this offseason. And monster, I'm talking like, we're talking... 8 times 8, 8 times 9.
Wow.
Easy. Especially just the way that blue liners are going. A lot of people compare him to Charlie McAvoy, and you look at McAvoy's second contract at 9.5, Heiskanen at 23, got huge money. Obviously, we've seen Owen Power, Jake Sanderson, Ekblad back in the day. The blue liners, the price for top ones are going up, and this guy has been thrust into a position on a team that has had meaningful games all season long to essentially be their number one defenseman without Spurgeon out. And if Spurgeon doesn't get hurt, I don't know if we realize what a revelation he is. I mean, he's never played power play in college, and yet he's been running their power play since John Hines essentially took over. I mean, imagine what his point total would be if he played a sniff of power play to start the season.
Right.
You're right. I mean, there's no doubt that that Bedard, I think, is the clear-cut number one the rookie of the year is somebody that usually, there's really no formula for it. Like, it's usually just who the rookie is that catches your eye that's been the most exciting.
Yeah.
It's not like, you look at it like Hart or Vezina and really do a lot of analytics into it. So Faber, you know, for me, he's been every bit as impressive or more than Bedard, just because he's had to play meaningful games from opening night on, where Bedard has not. And he is at 21 years old running their defense, essentially captaining their defense, will be the next captain of the Minnesota Wild. So he's been outstanding. But as you said, I think that this is Bedard's award without a doubt.
Yeah. Okay, off the Minnesota Wild page here. I am curious what you thought about everything that you heard, saw, thought about since coming back from the general manager's meetings. Unfortunately, you had to spend a lot of time around Elliot Friedman. Russo, I can feel your pain there. But as far as whether it was, you know, speculation about, you know, HRR or speculation about Arizona or speculation about, you know, some minor tweaks to the rules, to more video being introduced into the game, what caught your eye more than anything else?
You know, I think the two big things are is just the need to have a larger, more robust video staff. You know, these guys, yeah. I think sometimes we all look at a video coach as their only job is to sit there and look for reviews for the coaches. Remember, the video coach's job is to sit there and watch an entire game.
Oh, yeah.
Far, you know, an endless amount of situations in game, whether it's breakouts or neutrals on forechecks, and constantly help from that standpoint. But now, not only are they, you know, looking at you know, high sticks and offsides and goalie interference, but at starting next season, assuming that the competition committee and the board eventually ratifies these suggestions, they're going to have multiple other things that they're going to have to look for, and it just feels like you have to have, you know, somebodies that are just focused on that. That's the other thing. And then the other thing was Arizona. Like, I just thought it was really interesting, again, that they keep on pushing the target date back for Arizona, and you just never know where it's going to go. But the one thing that Bill Daly said to us is that it probably, if they let this thing get to the June auction, even if the Coyotes fail, it's probably too late to move the franchise, unless behind the scenes there's like Winnipeg and Atlanta,
yeah,
we're secretly having a sale negotiated behind the scenes. You know, you have the ownership change. You have to move an entire franchise. You got a building to get to outfit for hockey. You have obviously players that got to move, an organization that has to move. So he basically said that June's probably too late to move the franchise. So it sounds to me like Arizona's staying there next year. And as a lot of Minnesota fans have pointed out, they sure wish that back in the early 90s that Gary Bettman and staff really tried to save the North Stars the way that they continually try to save the Coyotes.
Winnipeggers feel the same way as well. They can feel that. You know, the interesting thing about this, too, is I've kind of given up trying to make any pronouncements about what I think is going to happen with Arizona. Like, I'm really now of the mind where I'm just trying to hover above all of it and keep all options on the table in my mind, and be prepared for just about anything. Like, even like to your point, when Bill Daly said, like, look, even if we get to the auction, doesn't happen, we still can't pivot that quickly. I try not to make any assumptions based on that answer, Mike. Because, I mean, going back to the days of, geez, you remember Judge Redfield T-Bomb, who's no longer practicing, by the way, who has since retired, and this saga continues. I've given up guessing on what one thing means in relation to another. You know what I mean? Like, I've given up saying, this is so that will happen. Because we've seen so many different turns on this.
Well, I said to Elliot, I said, is there any doubt that next March at the GM meetings, we're going to be asking Bettman and Daly about the future of the Coyotes?
So yeah.
That's just the way, you know, it's the way this story has gone now for 3 years. And so I don't know. It's one of those things where it's hard for me to get angry about it, I'll say, as a Minnesota sports writer, because I love going to Arizona on road trips. So it's like part of me on a campaign against them. And I think we can all agree that even if by chance this organization does relocate, that eventually they're going to wind up back in Arizona,
yes,
like with expansion when Atlanta comes to town and things like that. So,
yep.
It's pretty. Sorry, I'm getting distracted. For the Blues. I got like a bunch of Minnesotas on the Blues coming over to me right now. How about Nick Leddy playing his 1,000th game against the Wild, the team that he never got to play a game for tomorrow night?
Yeah, how about that's going to be certainly something to look forward to. Listen, we'll get you back at it. We're up against the clock here. Thanks as always for stopping by. Enjoy talking to the Minnesotans. Enjoy having a conversation with Nick Leddy. And enjoy the weekend, as always, Mike Russo. Look forward to the Minnesota Wild and the St. Louis Blues. Blues, I mean, if anyone's got a shot here, maybe if you squint hard enough, you say St. Louis. We'll see how it goes. But I'm with you. I think Vegas is going to start to take the ball and run here. Thanks, Mike. Always Absolutely. A pleasure, man.
Yep. Anytime, Jeff. See ya.
The great Mike Russo from The Athletic, obviously at practice right now. St. Louis Blues. The Minnesota Wild tomorrow. Time now for Line Change, presented by Sports Interaction, your homegrown sportsbook. Bet local. And on Fridays, we have a look forward to our Hockey Night in Canada games and pull one out. And today we're talking about the Calgary Flames and the Vancouver Canucks. Canucks minus 1.5 in this one. The total has gone under in 7 of Vancouver's last 8 games. Vancouver are 6-2 straight up in their last 8 games. The total has gone over in 7 of Vancouver's last 9 games against Calgary. The total has gone over in 9 of Calgary's last 11 games. Calgary 2-4 straight up in their last 6 games. Calgary 13-7 straight up in their last 20 games against Vancouver. And I agree with Elliot, who stopped by at the beginning of the program today. And that is, you know, it's right around this time where, you know, Rick Tocchet is trying to get his team, you know, albeit there are, you know, injuries, most notably the Thatcher Demko, but trying to get the remainder of the team here ready for playoffs and get into a playoff mindset here. And the one thing about playoffs as well that I think we always have to keep in mind, you know, at a certain point, because injuries are an inevitability, certainly if you're going to have a long run, and I think everyone in Vancouver is hoping that the Vancouver Canucks have a long run here, injuries are going to be a factor. So you better make sure that various players don't just get locked into playing with a couple of other guys. You want to try to mix it up as well so you're not shocked into, I've never played with these two wingers before. How do I do this? Don't be surprised if Rick Tocchet starts to do that with his squad on the Calgary end of things. I think we're all hoping that Jacob Markstrom plays. I mean, I certainly am. We all know the season that he's had. It's Vezina Trophy worthy, and it's also been Vezina Trophy drama outside of what's happened on the ice. Look forward to this one. Vancouver Canucks hosting the Calgary Flames tomorrow on Hockey Night. That was Line Change, presented by Sports Interaction, your homegrown sportsbook. Bet local. Brian Burke on The Merrick Show next.
Everything Raptors, before and after the games. The Raptor Show with Will Liu. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is the Jeff Merrick Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
4 games on the go around the NHL this evening. Welcome to Hour 2. Amongst them, the Carolina Hurricanes and the Washington Capitals. Yes, Evgeny Kuznetsov returns to Washington. Caps head coach Spencer Carberry, this is a tweet from Tarek Al-Bashir, says this: I'm happy for him that he landed on his feet. He would have loved for it to be the fairy tale ending for Kuzi to be able to play here for years to come and retire as a Capital, but sometimes it doesn't work out that way. 1 of 4 games on the board tonight. The Carolina Hurricanes facing off against the Washington Capitals. All right, get ready for some good stories here and some interesting conversation. All from our guest, not from me. He is the one and only Brian Burke, Stanley Cup champion, and of course now he is the executive director of the PWHL Players Association. Burkey, how are you today?
Good, Jeff. How are you?
I am doing very well. And I want to get to some PWHL talk with you here in a couple of seconds. But, you know, we've just come off of another NHL general managers meetings. I mean, you've been to so many of these. And I want to get to some of your accomplishments and things you've been able to get over the finish line here. But from your previous experience, how do these things work? Like, how does, like, what happens when you arrive? Who sets the agenda? Who leads discussions? And then what happens when everybody disperses? Can you walk us sort of from the root to the fruit on the GM's meeting?
Sure. And let's go back to my first one, which was 92. That's how long ago Wow. My first GM meeting was, where the GM set aside time. We were in Innisbrook in Tampa, or we might have been, I think that first one we were in Palm Springs. And the GM said back then, they had the wisdom to say, let's set aside time every year to focus on rules. So they're going back 30 years now. The focus on this was always be on rules. Mm-hmm. Let's get away from the game, go to a nice place, sit down, get all the GMs, all the managers together, and folks on rules. So the way it works now is they refine it a little bit. It's in Florida. The meetings start on Monday. Say it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. 3 days. They start at 8 o'clock in the morning sharp. They're done at noon. They break for lunch. A lot of guys are made media available right away at noon. And they have golf or fishing 1 day. The other days they work pretty well. But they're done the meetings by 8, and they were 8 till noon. The way they do it is the league has a lot of people that work at the league now. So you got Stevie Walken as officiating guys. You got Colin Campbell as hockey ops guys. You got George Perros, player safety guys. They'll divide up and spearhead. They'll put you in small groups, so 4 groups of 6, 7, 8 guys. Depends on the topic.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll do it's not always even. That's why I'm saying that. It's not – I can do math, Jeff, but it's not always the same number of guys in each room.
Yeah.
And a couple times we've had, you know, guys filling in. So it's – they divide you up and they give you topics. So it might be video of the puck over glass might be one of your topics. And the other one might be, do we modify overtime? Do we want to put in a whistle or change of possession when a guy intentionally carries the puck back over the attacking blue line? These are all topics that were discussed.
Mm-hmm.
So they spend time on them. They have a group guy speak to each one. They bring the whole group back in and address them one by one. And then they go out and meet with the media.
Can you take us back to 92, to the first general manager's meeting in the NHL? Who are some of the top dog GMs in that room? Do you remember any of the conversations? Any of the arguments, any of the issues on the table, any, you know, bizarre dynamics play themselves out? Can you take us back to the first GM's meeting in the NHL?
Well, the first one I attended was I got stuck in the corner with Mike Smith, who was the GM in Winnipeg, I guess, at the time, maybe Chicago, Perry Sinden and Serge Savard. And they're all Greenpeace guys. They're all anti-fighting guys. And they all expressed his decision or opinion that fighting would have to be eliminated or reduced significantly. And I told them they were all out of their minds, which wasn't a good start for rookie GM when they all ganged up on me. And it was about that I learned that diplomacy wasn't my strong suit.
It may not have been your strong suit in that one, but at the same time, like I am always curious in these conversations, whether as you mentioned, like, you know, Harry Sinden's a legend, Serge Savard, a legend, like there's some big names here as new general managers join the mix, because you've seen this happen countless times. I mean, at some point, like you're going to these things for 10 or 12 years, and then there's a rookie GM who comes in. Is there any sort of, I don't know, hierarchy of, hey, you know what, this is your first general manager's meeting, kid. If we want to hear from you, we'll ask. Like, is there a sort of alpha element of these meetings?
Well, I think there's a common sense element to it. That's very common in hockey. I remember when I was a rookie playing in the American League, I didn't say a word till Christmas time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was hard for me because I was older than a bunch of the players. I was 22.
Yeah.
A lot of our players were first-year pros, were 20 and 21. And I'd played 4 years. But I kept my mouth shut for a long time. And then our captain, Dennis Patterson, took me aside and said, look, everyone appreciates how you're keeping your mouth shut. Even though you're a little older, you can speak up now. So I kept my mouth shut. Rookie GM meeting, your first 4 meetings, you have 4 meetings a year. My advice to rookie GMs is you should be seen and not heard. Mm-hmm. It was certainly my approach. It was my approach when I went on the selection committee at the Hockey Hall of Fame. It's always been my approach. The new guy, shut up and listen.
at some of these meetings, I know there's a number of proposals that you've put forward that you've tried to get over the finish line. And, you know, whenever I see the Jim Gregory Award handed out, I always think of you, because I know that was a big one. And maybe it goes back to 1992. I'm not sure. I've spoken to you about it a number of times. I know you had a lot of challenges getting it across the finish line, a lot of conversations, maybe a lot of arguments as well. Can you walk us through both the genesis and the ultimate victory of the GM's award, which would have been, I would imagine, I think it was 2010 that the GM finally relented and went forward with your idea.
took me 16 years, I think, or 17 years. It was my first year working at the league, and we were talking. I said to Gary Bettman, I said, why don't we have an executive of the year? And Gary said, well, the owners will never vote for that. It'll just cost them money.
Yeah.
And just, you know, he said, just forget about it. And so I kept bringing it up. So it took 16 years. And Gary ultimately became a great advocate for the award, realizing the value it has. I never won the award, but I'm very proud of the fact that I was instrumental in getting in. I think the other rule change that took me 7 years, and I didn't think of this. They thought of hybrid icing long ago. They experimented with the USHL long before I ever even heard about it. So I can't take credit for the concept, mm-hmm. but ramrodding that rule through, it took 6 or 7 years before we finally got hybrid icing. It took a bunch of serious injuries to get it done, to get it passed.
Right. Hey, who was on board with you and who was against you for this idea? Because it kind of does, like, I'll be honest with you, Brian, it kind of sounds like a no-brainer here. Like, I don't know where the resistance, I understand, like, you know, the owners, oh, it's another award and it's going to cost us money, but who was with you and who was against you?
Well, we never brought it to a vote. Gary just said, Gary was thinking of me and saying, you don't want to bring this to a vote. Don't bring it up in front of the owners because they're going to shout you down. Don't look like an idiot for no reason. So Gary's view was, not saying it's a terrible idea, but it's got no legs. There's no reason to spend bullets on a cause that's lost. Don't bother. So I brought it up after I left the league when people could still call me an idiot, but they had to do it a little more nicely. And so it took a long time, but I think it's a very prestigious award. I think there should be a GM of the Year. And to name it after Mr. Gregory was just phenomenal. Best guy in the world.
Absolutely. Did you have a manager in mind when you created this? Like, I'll be honest with you. I love that it's called, and I mean, this is my own bias because I loved, you know, the late Jim Gregory, a wonderful person, and absolutely appropriate that it's his name attached to this award. But, you know, I had thought, you know, if you're going to attach it to a manager, from the past, maybe, I mean, Sam Pollock, would make a lot of sense. Bill Torrey, would make a lot of sense as well. Maybe the award is a bow tie. I don't know. Go something goofy like that. But did you have a manager in mind when you first thought about this, Brian?
No, I really felt it was really important. I was blessed to know. I knew Sam Pollock to speak to. He was a great baseball man. People don't realize that. Yeah. He was a great fan and supporter and involved in baseball. And I fancy myself a two-sport guy with my involvement with Rugby Canada. So I really respected and liked Sam Pollock. I got to meet him a few times. I didn't know him well. But Mr. Torrey I knew quite well. I would have been happy with that name. I would have been happy with Slots. I would have been happy with any name. But I think Mr. Gregory, the reason being is probably because he was such a gentleman. You know, like, there, it's not a business full of gentlemen. Like, a lot of, like, I've got more. Mr. Gregory never had one enemy.
Yeah.
He was in the business for 30 years, never had one enemy. I have dozens, and he, you know, he hardly ever swore, and he'd always be a kind man. He'd always say, think about this, think about that.
Yeah.
Remember one of the first times I worked with him, we went to a game in Buffalo when I was working for the league. We drove back by a Tim Hortons, right off the QEW. And I said, I wouldn't mind getting a coffee. And Mr. Gregory said, you'll get recognized in there. People recognize. I said, no one will know who I am. So he said, I'm telling you, why don't I just go through the drive-thru? And I said, no, I want to go in and get a coffee, use the washroom. So I get in and I got surrounded and gooned by people. And it took me 10 minutes to get out of there. And Mr. Gregory never said a word, like, I told you so, or anyone else would have said, I warned you, I told you so. Mr. Gregory just got in the car and started driving. He's just a gentleman. He never, ever did anything that wasn't polite and sensible.
One more question about general managers, and I'm curious about your history and inspirations or mentors. Jason Ferris wrote a wonderful book called Behind the Moves about general managers and their stories and their history. And one of the things that I really like in that book is hearing managers talk about other managers. I know you're big, obviously, you'll talk plenty about Pat Quinn. And that's obvious, and that story is well told. But who are your guys, Berkey? Who are the guys that mentored you along, taught you a lot about this, how to react, how to act, how to behave, all of it? Who are your general manager mentors?
Lou, I mean, I was involved in the business when I first got started. Some of the, you know, like Lou Nanny was a giant back then.
Yep.
Mr. Allen, Keith Allen, I call him Mr. Allen. Bill Torrey, the late, great Mr. Torrey, he was wonderful. Cliff Fletcher is still working for the Leafs to this day. Even all these years later, was such a well-respected and well-liked guy, had such a intelligent viewpoint on everything. He was a giant in the room. But a lot of those guys, Harry Sinnen to me, Harry Sinnen's the smartest guy, and Slats would be the two smartest guys that I've ever met that never went to college. Mm-hmm. Like, these are brilliant guys. And that's why I've never confused education and intellect. Because I watched Harry Sinnen. Harry Sinnen called me once. I was watching the NCAA championship. Michigan had a triple overtime game. It was an afternoon game, and Harry called me the second the game ended and said, "Are you telling me we just had three overtimes and there wasn't one penalty called? They put the whistle away. It's garbage. We can't get like that." And I'm like, "Harry, it wasn't even my team playing. I wasn't involved. My team wasn't playing. Why are you yelling and swearing at me?" But that's Harry.
Yeah.
Harry was so smart. And you know what Harry hated? Mm. Harry hated that they congratulate the goalie after a win. Harry said, "I was just as important in that win as they were." Many people don't realize Harry Sinnen was an all-star defenseman in the Central League.
Yeah.
Was also a player coach. He's one of the last player coaches. Can you imagine being that important in that respect that you could play, be an all-star player, and then coach the team? Harry Sinnen was special. He still is.
A Reggie Dunlop, I was going to say. Harry Sinnen, one of the last legitimate Reggie Dunlops. To the managers' meetings that just concluded in Florida, and it seems as if the call of the day is going to be more video review. And I can distinctly remember Colin Campbell saying, you know, after the Matt Duchene offside and video review for offsides, you know, be careful because you're opening a door here. And think of the ramifications. And once that door is open, you can't close it. The old cliche, you can't get the toothpaste back into the tube. And here we are. Let me ask you, as much as we may be headed now for more video review in the game, is there already too much for you?
Well, they're too long for me. I think there should be a time limit on reviews except in the playoffs. I think it's taken 14 minutes or the longest review they've had, I think, in the NHL is 8 minutes.
Yeah.
That's too long for 18,000 people that paid to watch the game. That's too long. And people at home on TV, they can go, you know, use the washroom or grab a beer or whatever. But if you're sitting in the building, that's too long. So I think there should be a time limit on it. But I think getting it right is more important. And I think the league has expedited reviews. On a typical game, you might see two reviews, mm-hmm. and they're probably 2 minutes or less. So I think it's getting it right is more important than getting it expeditiously.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we all fought video review. We all fought it. They fought it in baseball. They fought it in basketball. They fought it in football. They all said that for the person, because the most important person in the building is the guy who paid $400 for that ticket.
Yeah.
The guy who wrote the check and bought that ticket. That's the one we got to keep happiest. He's the most important one, or she's the most important one in the building. So review is right from the outset, it seems counterintuitive to want review. You'd say, well, we want to have a good, fast game, but we want to get it right, too. So teams went to review reluctantly and slowly and incrementally, but I think they got it right in baseball. I think they got it right in football. And too many reviews in basketball for me, mm-hmm. but I think we got it right. Just I don't like the time that's spent on it.
The one thing that I keep coming back to, and I know I'm fighting a fight that's gone. I'm like the kid in the zoo who's lost his balloon, and I'm reaching forward and knowing that it's never coming back, that it's gone. But I was always a big fan of, and I still am to this day, close enough. Like, I think the spirit of offsides is as long as you're close enough to get into the zone, okay, that's good. As long as it's not Matt Duchene egregious, we're good. As long as it's close enough, kind of like how they treat dump-ins. You know, behind center, it's close enough. That's fine. Give them the benefit of the doubt. I always liked that at the blue line. Like, I don't know about you, Brian, but like, I like hockey with a whole lot of gray in it. I don't like trying to make it black and white, because that just leads into turning the game into a review of pixel by pixel by pixel. And really, they don't really matter that much. To me, close enough is good enough. Is it that way for you?
I will tell you, Jeff, I really believe that what's happened with review is on line calls, I think the linesmen are waving off all kinds of offsides that might not be offside, and they're calling offside because they're afraid they'll be overruled.
Yeah.
They're blowing plays dead that aren't offside.
Hmm.
So I'm kind of in the middle on that. There are calls I hate where I say, I'm watching the game, and I no longer have a dog in this fight, right? I don't work for a team anymore. And so I no longer care about the outcome of a particular game. But I'll see an offside where a guy dumps it in. It's clearly, clearly legal to me. It's not offside, and they blow it just because it's close. They just want to be sure. It's easier than getting overruled.
Yeah.
Just blow it dead. So I think we're getting 10 whistles, 8 whistles a night that are phantom whistles that don't need to be called.
Huh.
So I'm kind of somewhere in between them. I want to get it right, especially in the playoffs. So close enough, that doesn't work. For guys like me, GMs, that doesn't work.
So I was having a conversation with Dave Jackson last week.
And your
name came up, but I brought your name up deliberately. And we were talking about, obviously, rules and officiating and how the game is called. And, you know, he mentioned, when I mentioned your name, he said, oh, yeah, that was my boss. Brian Burke was my boss. And I mentioned the Brian Burke first call segment that we used to do on the show together, you, me, and Elliot on Wednesdays. And, you know, Brian Burke, you know, it was Brian Burke's first call, I think is what we called it. And your point was always, and I'll get this in your words, the most important call an official can make is the first one. Can you take it from there, Brian, the Brian Burke first call rule? Because Jackson agreed with it. He's like, oh, yeah, I remember Brian talking about this. Walk us through Brian Burke's first call rule.
Yeah, it's not Brian Burke's. It's Brian Lewis's, and it was before him, I think. Mm. Probably someone, one of the supervisors, even before Brian. They preached this at training camp. You went to training camp with the officials. They preached this. This was an absolute unshakable tenet of being a good official. Was the first penalty has to be a legit call. It's got to be a call of 19,000 people in the building. 19,000 people, 18,000 of them agree that's a penalty. So ticky-tack stuff, borderline stuff, cannot be the first call, because if you call the first one and they score on the power play on a blown call or ticky-tack call, now the referee's chasing the game. He's trying to make that call up subconsciously. The referees have great autonomy. They have great integrity, but subconsciously they're thinking, I cost them a goal. They're down 1-0. I got to make that call up somehow. And they don't make it up on a flagrant call. They make it up on a 50-50 call.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a coin toss. And I want the referee, what I used to tell them is, if you're reaching for your whistle and you're not sure whether to blow the whistle or not, then don't blow it.
Mm.
That's not a call. We don't want the call. If it's that iffy, then don't blow it. Take your time. The whistle can come up a little slow. If you don't think it's a call, put your hand down. But the first call was critically important. I still believe that. I'll still yell out at people watching the game, oh, that's a bad first call.
Hmm.
Meaning the first call has much more vital importance than the second or third one.
So that is, just we're all on the same page, that is the call that establishes the line. That's the call that establishes the standard. And that's important for both benches. So both benches know this is the line. So that's the indication from the official to both teams. That's the standard, period, correct?
Yep. You step over that line, they're blowing a whistle, and that should carry on for the whole game. But the first call, you can't be down 1-0 on a shaky call.
Yeah.
You cannot be down 1-0 on a poor call.
Let me ask you about George Parros. And, you know, he was front and center at the general manager's meetings. The Department of Player Safety always does a presentation. It sounds as if Parros has, I don't know, not deflected, but sort of, you know, softened criticism by saying, like, you know, look, like, to all the managers, like, if you want to be part of this, if there are issues that you have with how the DOPS operates, you know, please, our doors are open. Please feel free to come work with us, sit with us, do whatever you want. But, you know, if you want to complain about how we do our job, please come and be part of the entire process with us. Everyone's trying to get up to the same point on top of the mountain. Everybody has a different path to get there, as we all know. I always think about something that you told me about, essentially, for lack of a better term, Brian, the sheriff position. And I remember you told me years ago, I mean, 10, 15 years ago, you said, Jeff, it is the worst position in the NHL. And I said, why is that? And you said, because every morning you wake up, everybody in the league thinks you're an idiot. Because no one will agree with any of your decisions, anything, however you feel. Everyone will think that you're always wrong. It is a lonely, lonely position. How do you think George Parros is doing? How do you think Parros is handling it?
You forgot one thing.
What's
that? You're stupid in two languages in Montreal.
That's right. Yes, so you did say that. Yes, that's right. You're stupid twice.
So it's not just 32 teams. You get two barrels in Montreal. So no, it is. And I say to people who complain when I did the job, I'd say, I would like to see you last 1 week in this job, where virtually every decision is criticized.
Yeah.
And it's not, even when they think you got it right. So let's say Tom Wilson, he's got an in-person hearing scheduled. Let's say he gets four games, they call in person. Let's say he gets five games.
Yeah.
Right away, the cacophony of critics will be, it's not enough, it's too much. And then there's idiots who will say, well, I think every high stick should be 10 games. If they gave every high stick 10 games, high sticking would disappear. They don't realize what George Parros has to do is walk the balance between keeping physicality in the game and penalizing transgressions. And that requires that you let certain things go that we don't mind that guys go on, they walk on that wild side, they walk on the line. I said this before, and I remember David Amber was horrified and shocked that I said this. Thank God we have players that cross the line. Thank God we have players that are willing to walk that line. That means we're keeping hitting in the game. When they cross the line, yeah, bang them. But we want a physical game. We need hitting in this game. We need hitting to sell tickets in this game. It's an integral part of our game. That's the tightrope. So George has to say, I'm going to keep hitting in the game. I'm not going to say every guy that does this gets 10 games. I'm going to walk that line. I'm going to keep hitting in the game. I'm going to penalize the people across the line. It is a tough job.
Yeah.
George does a great job.
If you can do it, because you mentioned Tom Wilson, he does have a hearing by way of Zoom, offered the in-person. So listen, this could be a 6-gamer, could be a 10-gamer, 15-gamer. We don't know. This for the slash across the face of Noah Gregor. In the couple of minutes that we have left here, Brian, can you quickly walk us through, A, how long one of these hearings takes? I think there's a feeling that these hearings take a long time. It's, you know, 4 or 5 hours and presentations and all of that. How long does it take, and what's the dynamic? How does it work?
Well, we got to talk PWHL at some point.
Yes, we will.
Jeff Merrick,
we will.
Be sour. But quickly, I'll give you the Reader's Digest version. About 10 to 15 minutes is a long hearing.
Yeah.
Because typically, George goes first. He does the preamble. This is to determine what happened in this game. There are no rules of evidence. The player can say whatever he wants. He can introduce video.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of rules of evidence. It's not admissible in regular hearings. There's no rules of evidence in this hearing. They can introduce hearsay. They can say this guy said that. They present their case as best they can. The union usually weighs in. The GM comes back in and says, this, you know, my player, Tom Wilson, is a really valuable player. He's physical, but he's really important to us. And so, and then the union says, we got to protect both sides, but Tom Wilson, if he has no history, they say he has no history. Can't really say that for Tom.
Yeah.
But it's about 15 minutes, and then player safety will weigh in. All the people have some input on it, and then George will make his call.
Okay. PWHL, as you mentioned, I can't believe it's taken us this long, but I'm a bad host. Here's what I want to ask you, Brian. We just saw two really successful events run in Detroit and Pittsburgh, and I think that leads to the obvious question. I mean, it certainly looks as if these are destinations for the PWHL. Should we make that assumption already, or is it still in the planning stages and there's no, you know, expansion on the horizon, but these may be markets of interest? How about that? How should we feel about the PWHL already having gone to Detroit and Pittsburgh for two very successful events?
Well, I think you're right. I think it's a trial balloon. I think it's a test tube, whatever analogy you want to use, whatever description you want to give it. I think it is doing a dry run in the marketplace to see if that marketplace will support women's hockey at the pro level in the future. My understanding is I don't talk to ownership there at all. So I'm head of the Players Association.
Yep.
I talk to people that work in the league. I don't talk to ownership at all. Never met them, never talked to them. So I'm going with you on that waste. But what I think I believe is the case is, yes, expansion will be something they look at in the future. They are interested in trial balloons. Pittsburgh was no accident.
Yeah.
Detroit was no accident. But I don't think it's a priority for this year. I don't think anyone thinks they should expand this coming fall.
The PWHL Toronto team has been a phenomenon. I know it wasn't exactly the best start Natalie Spooner's team here, Sarah Nurse's team, Kristen Campbell's team. We're not a fast team, but all of a sudden, you know, this Toronto team, Berkey, looks like the proverbial juggernaut. I know you work for the Players Association, but I want to ask you a question about league health. And from a league health point of view, I was told at the beginning of this season, it is crucial for the PWHL to have a successful team in Toronto. Is that accurate?
No, well, I think everyone, I will tell you as from working for six teams in the NHL, everyone likes when Toronto has a powerful team because it drives ratings and it helps, but no, where that doesn't fall apart or where that logic falls apart is that somehow things were manipulated to so Toronto had a good team. What they have is a really good GM.
Yeah.
They have a really good head coach, and their stars have really stepped up. This is the best year Natalie Spooner's had in 5 years for me watching her for 5 years. She's playing great. Sarah Nurse is a great player. Renata Fast. Campbell's been unbelievable in that. Yeah. So they're getting great performances, and they're well-coached and well-GM'd. But no, there's not some ulterior motive. Oh, we got to have a strong team in Toronto. We'd have a bigger building. We'd have a bigger building in Toronto if we could.
I do wonder if it ends up being for the playoffs, whether it's Scotiabank or perhaps Coca-Cola Coliseum, because to your point, they could sell a lot more tickets than they do at Mattamy right now. What do you think? We'll close on this one. At this point, it's 16, 17 games into the season. I'm not going to ask you about trends or emerging stars or anything, but what do you think are some of the more underreported stories about the PWHL that needs more concert? Like, we've talked about the stars and we talked about the teams and, Detroit and Pittsburgh and what's next, but what are some of the things that really interest you about this league at this point of the initial season?
Well, I think the number one thing you said, Jeff, I echo is the stars. So by only having six teams, we guarantee there's stars on every team, and they have carried the mail. They have been terrific. The women stars in this league have carried the league and really carried the standards. So that part's number one. Number two is the quality of play. Like, these women are fantastic. I've known that for 25 years. But for a lot of fans who have not followed the game that closely, one of the best things about going to watch the game is they're like, these women are outstanding. They can shoot the puck, skate. They make great plays.
Mm-hmm.
They're wonderful ambassadors. It's a joy to be around them. But the number one thing I've heard is physical play. People are astounded how physical it is. And like, that's embarrassing to people like me that have been watching it all along. Like, well, what did you think you were watching? But that's the number one reaction I get is it's been that way for a while, but this is a league that's saying we welcome that style.
So happy it's here. And we look forward to what's next in the PWHL, but still playoffs to get to. And I love the way they're doing the, first team selects from 3 and 4 who they face off in the opening round and protecting home ice for team number two. Up against it, Berkey, always a pleasure catching up. Great to see you again. You be well, and we'll see you around at our next PWHL game. You take care.
Thanks, Jeff.
There he is, the great Brian Burke, Stanley Cup champion. He is the leader of the union for the PWHL Players Association as well. Always good catching up with Berkey and hearing great general manager stories from the GM's meetings, going back to, as Berkey mentions, 1992. And speaking of general managers, player turned general manager for Hockey Canada, the upcoming World Hockey Championships, is former Columbus Blue Jackets sniper and now director of player development for the Columbus Blue Jackets, Rick Nash joins me in moments as the Merrick Show continues across the Sportsnet Radio Network, simulcast on Sportsnet 360, and wherever you get your podcasts. Back in a moment.
The most opinionated Maple Leaf show out there. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is the Jeff Merrick Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Welcome back to the program. I want to thank Brian Burke for stopping by, as always. And from one general manager to another, he is the general manager for Team Canada at the upcoming World Hockey Championships. Also, Columbus Blue Jackets Director of Player Development, to say nothing of being an elite and outstanding player on his own right when he played. He is the one and only Rick Nash, and he joins me now. Rick, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing good. First of all, congratulations on the nod. I'm always curious, you know, at what point does someone look at their life after hockey on the ice, and at what point do they start really entertaining the idea of working in management? Rick, before we get to Hockey Canada and the upcoming World Championships, at what point in your career, either maybe while you were playing or it happened afterwards, did you think to yourself, you know what, maybe I'd be interested in management?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say more towards the tail end of my career. You know, you start having a family of your own, and
Yeah. You
know, you start to realize that hockey, you know, the playing career is just a small chapter in your life. And so for me, it happened towards the tail end. I started thinking about other options, whether it was going back to school or, you know, staying in the hockey business. And I just always kind of gravitated towards how teams were built, and And you know, obviously in the cap era that we're in, just kind of the system that, you know, different people put into that always interested me. So right when I was finished, I knew I kind of wanted to move in that direction.
I just talked to Brian Burke a couple of seconds ago and, you know, asked him about, you know, mentors and people that, you know, helped him along the way. And you know, he's always talked about Pat Quinn, and he mentioned Harry Sinden, some of the older school guys. Who are the general managers that, you know, either you know, reached out, you've had conversations with, you have relationships with, that you would look at and you would say, you know, these are the mentors that that Rick Nash has?
Yeah, that's kind of fun to hear who the Bryans were. Some Toronto guys that I obviously grew up watching. You know, for me, I would have to say, first of all, Jarmo Kekalainen, and he was the one that brought me into to Columbus. And you know, after that, when I retired, I reached out to Jeff Gordon. I reached out to, Steve Yzerman, Don Sweeney, you know, GMs that I played for in the past. And, you know, another one was Mark Hunter, who's been running the London Knights for a lot of years down there, and did some stuff with Toronto there for a bit. So those are kind of guys that I looked up to and that I kind of turned to for knowledge. And also Doug Armstrong, you know, he's kind of taken over this, Hockey Canada thing and asked me to come on and do the world. So he's definitely someone that I look up to and that I played for at the Hockey Canada level.
You know, you mentioned Mark Hunter a second ago, and I find that interesting because, like, I've followed junior hockey forever. And listen, you're a London Knight. He's, you know, owner and general manager with the London Knights. It might not be a name that our listeners/viewers may be familiar with at the NHL level. You did mention that you had that stint with the Toronto Maple Leafs. But, you know, when you look at qualities that someone brings to the table, and you also mentioned Jarmo Kekalainen and his story is well told, you know, what does someone like Mark Hunter, you know, offer that would, you know, inspire someone like you? Or what does someone like you learn from Mark Hunter?
Yeah, well, I was their first draft pick. Yep. Coming in there to London when they bought the team, him and Dale. And it's a good question. What does someone learn from Mark? Well, I think his record speaks for himself. I believe they missed the playoffs once since the year 2000. You know, they obviously got a brand new arena built after I left, and we'd have to stat check this, but I think they produced the most NHL players in any other junior program in the last 24 years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the numbers kind of speak for himself, but I got to know the guy on the inside and how he handles himself, how he motivated his players, how he treated his players. So that's how I kind of look up to a Mark Hunter.
You know, the one thing, and I'll get off the Mark Hunter question here a second, but I just want to add one more thing to it. The thing that I've always been impressed by with Mark Hunter is how he seems to be everywhere. Like, whatever rink you're in, like, Mark Hunter was either is either there or was just there. And I don't know that I've seen, I'm going to probably offend a lot of scouts here, but here I go. I don't know that I've seen someone watch as many hockey games as Mark Hunter does and have a book on everybody like Mark Hunter does. Like, that to me, Rick, is my big takeaway when I hear the name Mark Hunter, is this guy is a hard worker. I don't know how many hours he has in his days. I only have 24. I don't know how many you have, but he seems to have more. And he has a book on everybody and is able to just spit it out no matter who the player is. Mark Hunter has in his mind the book on everyone. Do you have the same sort of feeling about Mark Hunter?
He's a worker, right? Yeah. You go into some of these small junior B games or you know whatever it might be, a minor hockey game, and Mark's there. He seems to be everywhere, you know, just driving his truck up and down the 401 to to every single game. So I'm with you on that. And you know, Jarmo Kekalainen was kind of in that mold too. I mean, this guy knew every single player, yeah, you know, whether they're in Europe or in junior or NCAA. And you know, I'm at the beginning of my post-playing career and trying to put the work in and trying to do the work and trying to, be half of what these guys are. So it's I'm with you on what you appreciate with them.
You are someone that always answered the call when your country called for hockey. There are some teams that are already out of the playoffs in the NHL, whether it's San Jose or Chicago or Anaheim, and there'll be more that drop off along the way here. What's your sort of internal protocol about when do you start approaching players about the Worlds? Is it as soon as a team is eliminated, you plant the seed, or do you wait for, you know, the season to, you know, start to draw to a conclusion? What sort of protocol do you work with?
Yeah, good question. So I did this, assistant GM with Shane Doan, yep, 2 years ago, and went through this process, and that, definitely helped me figure out how it works. And, you know, I feel like I'm at a bit of an advantage because I went four or five times and I know how, you know, how the players get asked and when they get asked. And it's not always the best time when you're in a losing season and, you know, mentally might not be prepared for to take on some more right now. But the reality of it is that we have a job to do and we got to put the best team together to win a gold medal. So, you know, I think in my case, you want to at least make sure they're mathematically, eliminated from the playoffs and don't have a chance. And then, you know, what I say most of the time is when we were beat out in Columbus, I kind of use the World Championships as my playoffs to figure out what it's going to be like once you do get to those playoff games sometimes. So,
right,
you know, there's a lot of positives that can come out of it, but every situation's different. Calling all the different GMs, you get different answers sometimes. Some guys like to wait. Some guys, you know, you can ask right away. So each case, I can say, is personally different.
Do you have a thought on, because we've seen this happen before. Like, I remember when, you know, Jonathan Toews, you know, played for Team Canada at the World Championships before he played in the NHL. Do you have a thought, or maybe should we be expecting someone who's not in the NHL, maybe is 18 years old? Do you have a thought on, you know, players that aren't in the NHL yet playing for Team Canada?
Yeah, I think, I remember, I'm not sure if it was Jonathan Toews the 1 year I went, or Kyle Turris, I think, did it too. I might have been actually with both of those guys when they did it. Mm-hmm. I think Adam Fantilli might have done it last year.
Yep.
So I think it's interesting. I think it's fun for those guys to get an experience to be around the pros. Obviously they're going to be high draft picks the upcoming year. Mm-hmm. I don't know how deep we're going to have to go down our depth chart this year. I don't know the answers. I feel like there's some excitement around international hockey with the Four Nations and the Olympics coming up and NHL yes, players being back in it. So that's kind of the thing where we're going to be trying to hit a moving target. And if it comes down to, asking a kid that's in NCAA or in junior, then we'll cross that bridge when it comes.
You know, that's a really interesting comment by you. I want to see if I can push that a little step further, because, you know, you mentioned that international hockey right now, there is a landscape for NHL players, as there always has been. But now, to your point, there's the Four Nations face-off. There's the Olympics on the horizon. Do you find that it's what that the presence of these international tournaments adds a sort of other layer of pressure for players to say yes, that you don't want to be saying no to Hockey Canada for any event, especially if you want to play in one of these other events on the horizon. Do you think that's accurate? Sort of, you know, take yourself into the mind of a player here, as obviously you can. Do you think that that might make your job a little bit easier here as you try to recruit?
Yeah, there's a lot of answers to that question. Will it be easier with the landscape? I think it will be easier. It was harder 2 years ago, I think. Now, in saying that, if someone does not want to go, does it kill their chances for Olympics or Four Nations? Absolutely not. Do I think there's a great opportunity for some guys that may be on the bubble or that are on the team that could even put a better foot forward by going over to the Worlds mm-hmm. and having a great tournament? Absolutely. I think that's where the opportunity is going to come in. So it's exciting time. I just feel like guys are going to be really excited to go over and wear the red and white maple leaf.
How come you never said no?
You know what? I said to get my tonsils out once, funny enough. Yeah. And that was the only time that I couldn't go where I said yes, and then I had emergency surgery. Why I have never said no, it's probably because it was always my dream to play for Hockey Canada. You know, I remember growing up in Brampton and playing on road hockey by myself and always pretending that I was playing for Hockey Canada and a gold medal game. And, you know, whether it was Steve Yzerman or Doug Armstrong came knocking for the world championships. I would never say no. And you know what's funny is I tell the guys now, I was so happy that I said yes all those times because the memories I made and the friendships I made at that 3.5 week tournament
sure.
were some that are still going on today.
And you get to see, and like I always, you know, follow the model. I always, you know, tell kids, you know, use hockey. Don't let hockey use you. And I've always looked at things like the World Championships, a great chance to go experience hockey in another culture, in another country, and explore a part of the world that maybe up until then you've never been before. Like there is an element of like using hockey to get a great life experience through all of this, Rick.
You know what? I couldn't agree more with that. And, you know, the relationships that you're going to build, the people you're going to meet, you know, around the hotel room, around the meal room, around the ring, people from other countries. And I love that line that you used about, using hockey.
Yeah.
And not letting it use you, because kids have to realize that even if you do make it to the NHL, you know, and you play the average 4 years or whatever it is, or you make it your 10 years, it's just such a small chapter. So
yeah.
These are, like you said, these are lifetime experiences that I got out of firsthand, and now I'm going to be part of it in a different way that I'll remember for the rest of my life.
That's fantastic. We're up against the clock. Rick, thanks as always for stopping by. You always answer the call when we call, just like you always answer the call when Canada calls. Best of luck at the World Championships. Good luck putting the team together.
Hey, thank you so much. My pleasure. Take care.
There he is. Rick Nash is the general manager for Team Canada at the upcoming World Hockey Championships. It was Columbus Blue Jackets director of player development as well. One of the interesting things around Columbus right now is the Alex Nylander phenomenon. You want to talk about a player finally finding a home? It seems as if Nylander has found one there. Every time he plays, he's scoring a goal. That's been a great fit. We'll see what the future is. And, you know, that's a team that also is in search of their next general manager. I think that, you know, somewhere down the road, Rick Nash is going to be a GM in the NHL. Is he there yet? Probably by his own admission, no. I think it was interesting that he went out of his way to mention Mark Hunter. And we spent a couple of moments talking about Mark Hunter because I think that's one candidate that a lot of us wonder about. With regards to the Columbus Blue Jackets, but we'll see where that one goes. Okay, so a few things to wrap up the program here, and thanks so much for joining me, not just today, but all week long. We spent a lot of time talking about the Philadelphia Flyers and their situation with their captain and their coach. We spent a lot of time talking about the general manager's meetings in Florida, where we saw just sort of a flurry of a tiny little, like, little tweaks to the rule book that we'll probably see as soon as next season. Maybe some of them you like, maybe some of them you don't like. Nonetheless, they are moving this thing forward. As I mentioned on the podcast with Elliot that came out this morning, you know, I don't like when the league doesn't change anything for long periods of time. I think you should always be in a mode where you have a look at your game and say, is this reflecting the modern tastes of the modern sports fan? And if it isn't, then it's time to change or time to at least tweak. Thanks to Rick Nash for stopping by. Brian Burke, Mike Russo, Elliot Friedman. Our crew, Board Op, Austin Mackey. Great job, Austin, as always. Our TV director is Jen Roldnick. And I want to take a couple of moments as we wrap up to thank David Siss. It's David's last day here as producer. Matt Marchese returns as producer full-time next week. David's an amazing young man. It's his first full-time job producing one program. And it can kind of be a monster to jump in with both feet, but that's what David did. This young man's going to do a lot of great things in hockey, whether it's in media or in scouting as well. He's a scout for the Owen Sound Attack of the OHL, so he's living at the OHL Cup the next couple of weeks. Best of luck, David, and thank you for all your help here on the program. Merrick Show returns on Monday.